Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. You have me and I'm flying solo. And you might think that we're going to be talking about a famous person in history, but we're not. There is a twist to this. So I've got with me today Claire Martin, who's a historian of medieval London. She's now looking at, here's the code word for you all, the Boleyns, linked to London and where the family comes from. We're going to be talking about her new book, The Heirs of Ambition, The Making of the Boleyns. But we're not talking about Anne Boleyn, are we?
We are definitely not talking about Anne Boleyn. She's in the background, kind of. Everybody knows she's there when you're reading the book, and we know what is going to happen to her, but she doesn't actually make an appearance. This is her earlier family.
So that's exactly what we're going to be doing. We're going to be talking about before her, about the family, and not Anne. Well, I don't know. You might mention her once.
I might mention her name. We do have quite a lot of other Anne Boleyns as well, just to confuse everybody.
Oh, is this going to be another Matilda, Matilda, Matilda and Henry?
They're a bit more of an Anne, and Thomas.
Okay, I think you're going to have to name the A, B, C and D. You're going to be talking about...
It's okay, Anne. I'm not going to mention all of them, so hopefully it won't be too confusing.
If we talk about the Anne, you've got to mention the Anne.
We have the Anne with a capital.
Okay, so let's get, because Chris has written us some nice questions here. So we're going to start, as I just mentioned, we're not going to be talking about the Anne. We're going to be talking about the early 14th century, which that way before her time. And I'm so going to pronounce this incorrectly, which is Norwich, is it Gaul?
Jail.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. But the J spelling, but yeah, okay. Norwich Jail.
Norwich Jail, which brings us to Nicholas Boleyn, which is not an Anne or a Thomas, but Nicholas Boleyn and his family. Tell us about them.
So Nicholas Boleyn is not quite the first member of Anne Boleyn's family that we know of. There was a John Boleyn before him, who we know rented a house from Walsingham Abbey at the end of the 13th century. But Nicholas is the earliest member of the Anne Boleyn. So Nicholas Boleyn isn't quite the earliest member of the family that we know anything about. There was a John Boleyn before him, who we know rented a house from Walsingham Abbey, and that was at the end of the 13th century. But Nicholas is the earliest member of the Boleyn family that we can say anything about. And he was the five times great grandfather of the Anne Boleyn. And in 1318, he was to be found in the jail beneath Norwich Castle. He had been arrested on appeal, which meant somebody else had been caught and had admitted they were guilty and then had named him as an accomplice in an attempt to save their own skin. And in this case, it was somebody called Benedict Boleyn, who we know must have been a relative of his, but not the exact relationship. And the crime that he was accused of was stealing 40 shillings of cloth from a man not in Norwich, but in Lincoln. And because of the value of the goods, that was a capital felony. So Nicholas's life was in jeopardy, and the Boleyn story could have come to a very early end. Fortunately for him, juries rarely convicted people accused in this way because they knew it was often a made-up, self-serving accusation. And Nicholas provided witnesses to say he was of good character. And to try the case, they needed a jury of men from Lincoln, which was difficult to produce in Norwich. And that worked in his favour. And there's no results to this case. It seems to have just been dismissed. So he was able to finally leave Norwich Jail and head home to his village, which was a small village called Saul, which is just north of Norwich. And then the next time we come across him, he's again in trouble, although this time the rather less life-threatening crime of his straying sheep causing damage to other people's property. That resulted in him having 12 of his sheep seized or distrained to ensure that he put the damage right and then they would be returned, which is quite useful for me because the fact he had at least 12 sheep and probably more tells me that he was at least somewhere in the middle of his village society and probably slightly higher. So Nicholas's son was John, and then his son was Thomas, the first of several Thomases. And they, like the rest of their family, survived on two strings to their bow, if you like. Farming, as you would expect from peasants in a small Norfolk village, but also the textile trade, because they were slap bang in the middle of the area of Norfolk that produced worsted cloth. And their village in particular was known for producing woolen caps or hats. So John, fortunately, survived the Black Death, which hit their village particularly hard. And they began to prosper, making the most of the fact that now there was more land available in an area that had previously been very densely populated.
I've got to say, it's quite interesting to think about that Anne Boleyn, the Anne Boleyn, ends up marrying, on this podcast, we've referred to him as the Fat Ginger Man.
she does indeed.
she becomes royalty, yet her family come from a small village. Who, okay, so like you said, somewhere in the middle, but they're more or less, they're still peasants.
They are definitely peasants. They were always free peasants. So they rented unfree or villein land, but they were never villein status themselves. So, I mean, the scale of peasantry, that makes them slightly better off than unfree peasants. But yes, they were basically small rural farmers.
It's just such an incredible jump to go from that to, I mean, how many generations of family? You said five generations?
Five generations.
Five, that's an incredible.
Yeah, six, yeah.
It's an incredible, I mean, obviously you're going to explain to us how we got to this stage in a moment.
Yeah, well, that was the fascinating thing to me, that in a period that you think on the surface seems very rigid and very hierarchical and there can be no change, it was completely possible, particularly in the 15th century, for people to really change the class and the status of themselves. It usually took several generations. And London often plays a big part in it, which was my interest.
Okay, right. Okay, so then let's move, because here we see a bit of a change for Geoffrey Boleyn. Tell us how his fortune changed the Boleyn family.
So Geoffrey Boleyn was the son of Thomas. And just to make it clear at this point, there are two Geoffrey Boleyns. So we're talking about the older one, father and son at the moment. and his growing prosperity was based, as I say, on the fact that there was more land available, but also on the textile industry. So by the opening of the 15th century, we could say that Geoffrey had definitely moved up slightly and would now be at the top of village society. They were not just renting more land, they were actually buying freehold land of their own. And his lifestyle was still, he was still essentially a farmer. He was still connected to the farming cycle of the year. For example, he's recorded selling straw for thatching. But he's also recorded with a debt of £14 from a cloth merchant living all the way in Bristol, which is one of the few bits of evidence of how important the textile industry was to the family. He was one of those leading members of the village involved in building Saul's disproportionately enormous church, which is still there. And a lot of the 15th century interior remains and is well worth a look if you're in Norfolk. And by this time, he had probably passed the 40 acre threshold, which placed him in the peasant aristocracy or yeomanry. And then in 1434, this was officially recognised, if you like. And along with just three other men from his village, Geoffrey had to swear an oath against maintaining or harbouring lawbreakers, which was applied nationally. And it does make it sound as though as if he was some sort of crime lord. But it simply recognised the fact that he had influence within his county. And I don't want to sort of overemphasize this too much because it wasn't a particularly exclusive list. There were 400 men from Norfolk alone, but for the Boleyns, it did still mark progress.
So you mentioned there is a younger Geoffrey Boleyn. So we just spoke about the older one. We're going to now talk about the younger one. And he actually ends up leaving Norfolk and he heads for exactly what you work on, which is London. Tell us about him, why he left.
So Geoffrey, the elder Geoffrey, was now a big fish in a small pond. And he had to think about what happened next. Some families took a different option to the Boleyns and they just carried on slowly building up the amount of land they held and saving money and were gradually able to maybe buy a manor instead of being a tenant on a manor. But if you were more ambitious than that and you had a bit of money behind you already to get a foot in the door, as it were, families could massively speed up this process of social advancement by means of a career in the church, in the law, or by London commerce. So the elder Geoffrey had two surviving sons, and the eldest Thomas went off to Cambridge and then had a very successful church career, while Geoffrey set out for London and an apprenticeship with a hatter called Adam Book. And that links with, as I mentioned, Saul's hat production, because his father was probably able to arrange this because he knew Adam through their links to hat production and the textile industry. So the fact that Geoffrey was going off to London, not just with hope in his pocket, but and on the off chance of making it big, he had an actual apprenticeship lined up, which was what you needed to get into the obtain the freedom of the City of London and the advantages of a London citizen. And that was the opportunity that he needed to make his fortune. So this is the familiar story to anyone who's ever been off to the pantomime and seen Richard or Dick Whittington going off to London to make his fortune. Actually, the real Richard Whittington was in the generation previous to Geoffrey. But this did assume that he had the talent to make the most of that opportunity.
Because it wasn't easy to be able to live in London at this time, was it? You needed something to keep you grounded rather than ending up on the streets, which could have been quite...
So people that came up to London without this kind of setup established, you could come and you could be a labourer or you could go into domestic service, but most trades or professions were closed to you. So you needed this apprenticeship to get a foot in the door to access citizenship.
So he ends up, well, he doesn't want to just be an apprentice working in a shop, really, at the end of the day. He wanted more out of life, didn't he?
So, yes, he certainly did. So London needed all of these people coming up, apprenticeships or other people, to maintain their population. But the outcomes of apprentices varied hugely. Many didn't even complete their apprenticeship. And even if they did, they might have just become a craftsman or a shopkeeper. Not all were involved in mercantile trade, importing and exporting. That was where the real money was. And even those that weren't necessarily hugely successful at it. But Geoffrey was lucky in that Adam was not just a man with a hat shop. He was a successful international merchant. And John Stowe conveniently tells us he was so wealthy that he was able to pay for the glazing of most of his parish church, St. Mary Le Bow. And as it turned out, he would be not just Geoffrey's master who got him through his apprenticeship, but a really close friend and probably a second father figure. In fact, they became so close that Geoffrey included Adam in his family chantry when he died alongside his own real parents and paid for him to be remembered in prayers for his soul at Cambridge. So Adam gave him, yes, a good education and an apprenticeship to get him into citizenship, but also that sort of mentoring and the support of somebody who was a friend. And then Geoffrey obviously had the talent to succeed. So he didn't spend long in the small guild of the hatters, which was quite a minor guild for London. And he transferred to the much more wealthy and powerful mercers, the most powerful guild in the city, and went straight into the livery or upper ranks of the guild. His career was hugely successful. And by the time he died in 1463, he was able to leave cash bequests of around £5,500 plus property worth several thousand pounds more. A huge amount of money in this period. And it made him one of the richest merchants in the city.
Do we know roughly what that is today?
I think I did work it out at some point, but I can't remember.
No, that's fine. Don't worry.
Okay, yeah,
So
sorry.
what do we know about his family life? Because he also has a wife and she's called Anne, not the Anne, but Anne.
No, not the Anne, but the first Anne who brought the name into the family, and then there is an Anne in every generation after this. They stick with it and keep passing it down. So Geoffrey's wife was Anne Who, H-double-O, the daughter of a knight, Thomas Who, and then he became a peer, being made Lord Who and Hastings. So unlike the Boleyns, they were a very long-established gentry family. Anne's father was a military man, and a diplomat, and spent most of his career in France. And he also brought very good connections, being very strongly associated with Henry VI's right-hand man, the Earl or later Duke of Suffolk. So the Boleyns were obviously thinking, this is a great match. We've got these connections here. This is going to offer us great opportunities. Unfortunately, 5 years after the marriage, the Duke of Suffolk was dead, and Lord Who was permanently and very damagingly associated with the vast and catastrophic loss of English territory in France. So they didn't get that advantage, but Anne and Geoffrey, most importantly for this family, had five surviving children, three girls, Alice, Anne, and Isabel, William, their younger son, and their elder son, Thomas, who was born in 1446. So although we don't have a specific record of their marriage, it was probably shortly before this. And there are hints that it was probably in the summer of 1445, because Anne's father, Thomas, seems to have been on a mission to sort out his family. He came back from France. He was a widower with just one grown daughter, and he needed an heir. So he arranged a new marriage for himself, and he resettled property that would have been inherited by Anne onto the children of his new wife, should there be any. Anne herself was around 20, which was more than old enough to be married in at this period. But her mother was obviously dead sometime previously, and her father was often overseas, so this has probably been neglected. But now her father had a new wife about to come into the household, so it was time to get the grown-up daughter out of the way and marry her off. And Geoffrey was convenient because, while the Whos had rank and property, there seems to have been something of a lack of cash that would have been provided, that could have been used to provide a large dowry to attract a more established family. When Lord Who died, it turned out he was in huge debts, and most of his, well, all of his executors refused to act. Geoffrey, of course, didn't necessarily need the money. He had proved he was very capable of making that for himself. What he needed was a link to a more established family and these useful connections. But conveniently for the Boleyns, Anne's father's second marriage produced only three more half sisters. So Anne became one of four joint heiresses, and the Boleyns inherited property from the Hoos in Norfolk and their main house at Luton Hoo in Bedfordshire.
That's really, really unfortunate.
Well, it was quite
Oh,
fortunate for the Boleyns.
it was fortunate for the Boleyns, but not for Anne's father, where.
No, but interestingly, this pattern of families not being able to produce male heirs or any heirs at all is part of what makes this society able to be flexible and allow people to climb up through society. Because, I mean, you've got to remember, it's a society where wealth and status is based on land. So if you're advancing your family, you have to be able to acquire land. And if all of the families already there were producing male heirs to inherit it, the property market would have been very locked down, and it would have been harder for families like the Boleyns to move up and to acquire the property that they needed to increase their own status.
So even though her father was, I don't know, what's the right way of saying, not demoted, but not so high in society, they still managed to advance their wealth through, when he died, obviously, property and money.
Sorry, whose father are we talking about? Anne's or
Anne's father, the
Anne
knight.
whose father? The knight. Yeah,
Yes.
yes. So their status. So when he lost his sort of position at court, that didn't change his status that was based on his the the ancientness of his family or the property that he owned. It just means he wasn't able to advance himself further because he'd lost his closeness to the king. He was probably also badly affected by the loss of territories in France. So people with strong connections to English territories in France generally suffered badly at this period. Well, I don't have records of exactly what property he owned. But he was given a pension to sort of make up for his losses, a pension from the crown.
So it's not a total loss because Geoffrey...
Well, it's tiny. I think it's £40, if I remember correctly.
Ah, well, yeah. I mean, so Geoffrey ends up... For him, it's great.
Yes, for him, it's great.
Not just the money, but the land. He's making such a good name for himself that he actually ends up going into politics as well.
So for somebody in his situation, this is inevitable. He does seem to have been, interestingly, quite unwilling. So city offices, particularly aldermen, were quite personally expensive and also quite time consuming. And Geoffrey obtained an exemption from the crown for offices which were classed as being under the crown, like the office of sheriff or serving on juries. And he presented a petition to the mayor and aldermen to try and be exempted from all city offices. This is not conventional, although the desire to get out of this sort of thing was usual. For example, there was another London merchant called John Gedney, who was elected alderman in 1415 and had to spend a period in prison to persuade him that he really did want to be an alderman. While Thomas Walsingham paid for glazing the vast new east window of the new Guildhall in order to escape. But the mayor and aldermen were not keen on allowing blanket exemptions from everything, or everybody would be trying it and there would be nobody left to run the city. But interestingly, as I say, Geoffrey did have this royal exemption from being a sheriff, and he was then elected to serve as one of London's two sheriffs. And he seems to have had a change of heart because he didn't actually try to enforce this and he simply went ahead and acted as sheriff. And this is only a very short period, I think about a year after he was desperately trying to get out of everything. And if you look at what had happened in between to change his mind, his first son had been born. And I think his resentment at being distracted from his business affairs by the business of the city was replaced by a realisation that the rank of alderman or mayor would enhance his own status and the prospects of his family. Suddenly, it wasn't all about him running his business. It was a bit more about looking forward. So he knuckled down. He was a sheriff. He was master of his company, the Mercers. He served as common councilman and as an MP for London. And then finally, after several nominations, he was elected as alderman for the ward of Castle Baynard in 1452. And he wasn't a particularly diligent alderman. Over the rest of his lifetime, he turned up to about half of the meetings, which was about average or just below. You weren't required to go to all of the meetings, but it was enough to place him in a position to be mayor.
Well, this is what we're going to talk about next. It was he actually was Lord Mayor. How was London under his governance, is the right way of saying it?
Mayoralty, yeah. First of all, I have to say he wasn't Lord Mayor. The mayors of London were simply the mayor at this period. So Lord comes in the Tudor period. But so he was simply Mayor of London. And he was elected in October 1457. And personally, that would have meant a huge upheaval in the Boleyn's peaceful home on Milk Street. The mayor of London was expected to live as a lord, and a large body of staff would have come with the appointment. They were sometimes provided with accommodation by the city, and some were given wages. But many had to be paid out of his own pocket, and he had to provide them with liveries and food and drink, just as a lord in the countryside would provision his own retainers. Hence the expenses Geoffrey had been hoping to avoid with all of this. But this was par for the course for being mayor. What was more problematic in 1457 was that the Cold War of the Roses had become hot with the Battle of St Albans in 1455, and London had been recently racked by a series of riots. And as mayor, Geoffrey's principal responsibility was to keep the city peaceful and secure. When he went on the great procession, the barge trip, to be installed before the barons of the Exchequer. This was specifically emphasised in the ceremony. And in this year, that would prove particularly difficult. So Henry VI had an idea that he could force his warring magnates into a sort of harmony by negotiating a settlement between the families who had been killed at St. Albans and those who had done the killing, and then stage a parade of apparently newfound friendship through the city on Lady Day, the 25th of March, which was renamed Love Day for the occasion. But in order to complete these negotiations, that meant all of these warring factions and all of their armed retainers coming together in the city in one place, which was just a pitched battle waiting to happen. And for Geoffrey, a massive headache. So by mid-February, there were around 3,800 armed men from opposing sides lodged in and around the city. So in response, Geoffrey is ultimately the man who's responsible for this. He raised a force of the city militia, some 5,000 strong. And every day rode at their head in a loop around the city and suburbs, which passed by all the houses where the principal lords and their retainers were lodged, basically to impress them and overawe them into keeping the peace. The negotiations went on for several weeks, and Geoffrey had to keep this up for several weeks, but it did work. There wasn't any outbreaks of violence, and negotiations were concluded. And the rather strange settlement of mortal enemies walking arm in arm through the city went off peacefully, although had no real effect and even at the time probably fooled nobody.
It doesn't get easier for Anne, especially when he dies, does it?
Well, actually, Anne was in a pretty good position when Geoffrey died. He left her hugely wealthy, completely independently in charge of that wealth, and completely independently in charge of looking after and arranging marriages for all of their underage children. So as a very wealthy widow, and with all of these children with huge inheritances and massive dowries coming their way, this was a marriage market bonanza. All of the ambitious mothers and the men looking for a wealthy widow to set them up for life must have been absolutely pouncing on the Boleyns. But Anne chose not to remarry, so she remained an independent widow for the rest of her life. And she seems to have been much more interested in the marriages of her children. So Geoffrey had bought a large house at Blickling in Norfolk and extended it and renovated it and created a huge base there for the family. And that she made her regular home. But she also maintained a household in London for a number of years, and even seems to have continued running some of her late husband's business interests, which she was entitled to do as the widow of a London citizen. And 10 years after Geoffrey's death, John Arundel of Cornwall owed her and two of her sons-in-law the grand total of £600 for merchandise he had purchased in London. So she was obviously a very capable woman who probably had been a partner in Geoffrey's business affairs for their married life. It's just that we can't see her until she becomes a widow. So she arranged good marriages for all of her girls to established gentry families who must have been very happy with the dowries of 1,000 marks left by Geoffrey, which is a vast dowry. But interestingly, we know that Anne didn't see the question of her daughter's marriages as just an extension of her business affairs. And we know this because in 1467, the younger John Paston, who was from another Norfolk self-made family — this is a very go-getting county in this period, and there are quite a lot of self-made families from Norfolk — he thought that Geoffrey and Anne's daughter Alice would make him a good wife. The problem was, as a younger brother, he had no inheritance, and so Anne had other ideas about how good this match would have been. And she is reported as saying that she would never advise her daughter to accept such a match. But if John and Alice wanted to marry, i.e. if they were in love, she wouldn't stop them. Which is in stark contrast to the way many other mothers and fathers treated their girls in this period. And particularly in stark contrast to John Paston's own Aunt Elizabeth, who is recorded as being beaten black and blue to try and force her into a marriage she didn't want. So the Boleyn girls were very lucky that their mother thought of their marriages in a very different way.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it is.
For that time period, like you said, you always have this image of, for example, a woman who is so adamant to make her daughter the perfect match. I mean, even when reading Jane Austen, for example, in that time period, it's all it, these women are hyper focused. That's all their life revolves around is making the perfect match and money and advanced in status, and that's it.
Yeah, and that was undoubtedly true for many, many mothers and their children, or fathers and their children. And it was important, but I think we sometimes forget that parents in this period did still love their children, although it's often said they didn't because mortality was so high, which is completely untrue. They did still, many of them, want the best for them, particularly if you were perhaps in Anne's position and hadn't been able to choose for yourself. We don't know exactly, as I explained, much about her marriage, but it seems likely that this was a marriage of convenience arranged by her father at the time, rather than her and Geoffrey being madly in love. And I think maybe that gave her sympathy for wanting her daughters to be happy. They also seem to have been really close, and there's evidence of the fact that once they were married, they still spent time together. Whereas, again, in contrast to the Pastons, who the Paston women seem to have been desperate to get their grown-up children out of the house and just been vastly annoyed by them.
Already mentioned this, so I'm going to stick with this, is that Geoffrey was affected by the War of the Roses, but how does this affect their fortunes?
So, yes, Geoffrey had clear Yorkist leanings during his lifetime, but fortunately for him, Londoners could not be compelled to fight outside the city. And so he wasn't involved in the Wars of the Roses in the sense that he had to fight and risk his life. But his sons were set to inherit substantial property in Norfolk and Kent, and that would not be the case for them as landowners. So William settled down at 18 or 19. With a much younger wife, Margaret Butler, a family who were under attainder at the time, but who would later be restored to the Earldom of Ormond, so a very prestigious match for the family. However, his older brother, Thomas, seems to have been more of an adventurer, and he joined the affinity of the brother of Edward IV, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, by 1469. Then we don't quite know what happened to him during the period of turmoil when Edward was forced off the throne. But he seems to have been with the Yorkist forces at the Battle of Barnet at Easter 1471, as 2 weeks later he died in London, probably from infected wounds sustained at Barnet. And this is the point where the Wars of the Roses change everything for the Boleyns, because previously their property inheritance was going to be divided between two sons, and William, as the younger one, had a smaller share. He had started at Lincoln's Inn, probably with a view to becoming a lawyer to supplement his income, but now everything was his. And all of the Boleyns' wealth would be united in his descendants, including his son Thomas and his daughter, the Anne Boleyn. And William was also linked to Richard, Duke of Gloucester. The family really went hard on this connection to Richard when he was Duke of Gloucester. And then, when Richard took the throne as Richard III, William was created a Knight of the Bath at his coronation. And he was also close to Richard's key ally, Thomas Howard, who appointed him Admiral, Deputy Admiral of Norfolk and Suffolk.
Right, I'm going to ask a really naive question here. You've mentioned the how. Is this the same Howards
Yes.
that? Right, okay. So this is, hold on, let me
This
rephrase
is
my.
where they first established that connection to the Howard family.
Okay, so for anybody who doesn't know what I mean, we're talking about Catherine Howard, who marries Henry VIII, who's his fifth wife.
Yeah, and also the same family as Elizabeth Howard, who is Anne Boleyn's mother.
Oh, well, there you go. Oh, my.
So they established the connection, and then later the two families marry.
Oh my, okay. Very complicated. Okay.
This period is a maze of interconnected family relationships and cousins and but people at the time kept this all in their heads, or probably written down, because these links were so important to how you secured advancement for yourself. You wanted patronage from this person who had a distant connection to you. So it all of this, which is incredibly hard to remember and keep straight in your head, was hugely important to them.
I wonder how many of these mothers would sit there with a family tree plotting to try and kind of advance their daughters or even their sons.
Whether
in
they
a
had
way.
I mean, some families certainly did have pedigrees written down, but if they didn't write it down, they remembered it. And yes, I'm quite sure that they were literally sitting there planning, right, well, we know this person who's connected to that person who married this person that we're related to, and we could get her into board out when she's a teenager with lady whatever, and then that will make good connections and she might find a good husband. Yeah, that was totally how society worked. Yes, it's great.
God, I think I'd want to hang myself if I was that kind of woman. No, just no. Right. Sticking with the War of the Roses following, well, Bosworth Field, you get a new king, new dynasty. How do the Boleyns fare with this whole idea that they sided with the House of York, now under Henry Tudor?
So the Boleyns have put all their eggs in the Richard, Duke of Gloucester, Richard III shaped basket, which didn't exactly go to plan. And just to make it, sorry, I said Thomas Howard earlier, I've just realised John Howard was killed at Bosworth as well. So that's their connection with the Howards gone as well. But they were lucky. First of all, they weren't important or prominent enough that their punishment was inevitable. And Henry VII took the view that he wasn't going to attaint or pursue every person, however minor, who fought for the Yorkist side. So William's strength was in his local knowledge and administrative skills, and Henry still needed men like that to make his government function. So the Boleyns adjusted to the new regime fairly seamlessly. William remained on the bench of JPs for Norfolk and continued to be appointed to local commissions. And he would ultimately serve as sheriff for both Kent and the joint shrievalty of Norfolk and Suffolk. Now, in 1487, Henry raised troops to deal with the Lambert Simnel Rebellion, and there were rumours that Henry and his forces had turned around at Thetford and were not going to join their king at all. But these seem to have been completely unfounded. He was lucky he'd got through the change of regime. He was in a good position and he had everything to lose. But you can see why a family that was so closely connected to Richard III before, people would have been a bit suspicious. But William wasn't a regular courtier. He was one of those who turned up at court for the big set piece ceremonial events when lots of people came, like the creation of Prince Henry, the later, what do you call him, the large ginger bloke, his creation as Duke of York when he was the prince, or the reception of Catherine of Aragon. But William didn't hold any official position. In comparison to his hugely ambitious father, Geoffrey, or his equally ambitious and successful son, Thomas, he's unfortunate in that he looks like a bit of a placeholder and a bit boring. But he seems to have been happy with simply the traditional gentry role as a county leader, which had effectively been bought for him by his father. He did, however, hand over the Boleyn estates to his son Thomas in robust good health, which was the most important thing because other families did suffer from generations of the family who were complete wastrels and lost all the money. And then in 1509, Thomas, his son, became the first of the Boleyn family to hold an official position at court as esquire of the body. And that would, of course, be the start of a hugely successful career for him, and an equally famous career for his daughter, the Anne Boleyn.
Okay, so because as you're going through these, I'm trying to picture who is who, and I couldn't remember Anne's father's name, and then I remember
So Anne is the granddaughter of William, her father is Thomas. So we got there eventually from Nicholas Boleyn in jail to the Boleyns holding their first position at court. And from there, it was upwards for them. And then downwards quite sharply.
I think if I'm looking at this as a whole, it looks like Geoffrey the younger, not the older, Geoffrey the younger is the one who really made their fortune and pushed it forward rather than everybody else. So his father was ambitious. Geoffrey the elder was ambitious, but not as ambitious as his son, Geoffrey the Younger.
Yes, he gave his son the opportunities to turn that ambition into vast amounts of money. It was that coming to London and making their fortune is a big chunk in the middle of the book, not just because it's my interest, but because it completely fundamentally changed the future of the family.
And his wife, Anne, obviously, yeah, as you mentioned, they kind of collaborated. Well, it looks like they collaborated together. And she must have been an incredibly smart woman at a time period where women were seen to just be in the kitchen or, you know, raising children or whatever, to be able to achieve what she did herself. So, I'm going to vote the most important person in your book is Geoffrey the Younger.
Geoffrey the Younger and Anne.
And
absolutely, yes. And they made good marriages later on. William's marriage to Margaret Butler was the marriage that meant the Boleyns were able to claim the earldom of Ormond, which probably wouldn't have been successful if Anne was not in the position that she was with Henry VIII by this point. But then her father became Earl of Ormond, and so now the family is titled. So you can see them using every little bit of connection and everything that they've achieved over the previous generations to work their way up.
Claire, this has been amazing. I've really enjoyed this. It's been a completely different take on just the generic Tudor sort of talk, basically.
Has been lovely to talk to you.
Can you just remind our listeners the name of your book?
The name of my book is Heirs of Ambition, The Making of the Boleyns.
Fabulous. When you come out with your next one, you have to come back on because I've been engrossed in this and this is such a different take and I loved it.
Lovely. So I certainly will. Thank you.
When you do, or even if you've got something interesting that you've been working on, I think it's really, because it is a form of genealogy and I love it.
Yes, exactly. So it's London history and genealogy all wrapped up in one of England's most famous families.
Exactly. And I love this. And hopefully people will go out and buy the book and learn a little bit more. So go out and buy a book. It was amazing having you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.